Well, good evening. Welcome to the Philson Historical Society. I'm Mark Wetherington, director, and I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight, and I hope for tomorrow, for it is going to be a very, very special spring Philson Institute entitled A Nation of Immigrants, How the Introduction of Different Cultures Changed American Society from 1820 to the Present. Before I introduce our keynote speaker, let me make a couple of announcements. First of all, I see a lot of members in the audience, but I see a lot of new faces. So if you're not a member of the Philson Historical Society, I would like to invite you to join us. We appreciate your membership very much. That's usually where I would stop, but now, as of a week ago, we had groundbreaking on our new expanded campus, and we had a great time, a lot of fun. I know a lot of you were there, and that date signaled our reaching $10 million on $11.7 million campaign. So that means we still could use some help, so it's not completely over. So there are brochures and cards in the lobby downstairs and the lobby on the stairwell out here. Our mission is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and the Ohio Valley region's history and culture, and certainly immigration is one of those key stories, and we're going to learn a lot more about that coming up. I could go into a lot of examples of immigration and its impact on our collections, but one of those would be the painting we have on the wall here of J. Stoddard Johnson, who was not a founder of the Philson, but was close to its early years, painted by Nicola Marshall. And Nicola Marshall was born in Prussia and came to America in 1849 on a transatlantic trip and entered through New Orleans. And on that trip, he sketched, and he sketched some of the people who were on the deck of that ship coming over from the old world to the new. Without further ado, let me introduce Tom Owen. Tonight he's going to lecture, A Place to Call Home, Louisville's Qualified Welcome to Newcomers, 1840 to the Present. Dr. Owen has been for almost 40 years an archivist for regional history at the University of Louisville's Archives and Special Collections. For 20 of the last 24 years, Tom has represented the Highlands neighborhood on the Louisville Metro Council. Dr. Owen holds degrees from Kentucky Wesleyan College, the Methodist Theological School in Ohio, the University of Louisville, and in 1981 earned a PhD in American history from the University of Kentucky. Tom has been a friend of the Philson for a long time, and I know many of you have enjoyed his presentations and tours over the years, and so it's always a pleasure for us to welcome Dr. Tom Owen to the Philson.
Thank you, Mark. I am awfully glad to be here. I am a friend of the Philson and recognize many, many, many familiar faces and always appreciate your interest in what we managed to do in telling the story of our community's history. I have a significant task before me. If I understood it correctly, I am to try to put my arms around the immigration history of Louisville, Kentucky from about 1840 to the present. And that is a big picture, a big challenge. And I will be moving through essentially a text, but I've commissioned Phyllis, my wife, who's here with me this evening, and at about 30 minutes in, she's going to give me a signal. And if I'm nowhere close to the end, I'll start winding down and quit at about 40 minutes in. All right? So I will spare you. I write sentences and paragraphs, and frankly, I didn't read everything in detail, and I'm sure along the way I'll want to embellish, so we'll see how this thing goes. Now, the major influx of Germans and Irish in the 1840s and 1850s was the only season that I could tell in Louisville history where we experienced what I would call massive immigration. And let me kind of step back for just a moment and say I will be mentioning in my comments basically three. So this is the roadmap to try to hold this talk together. I will be mentioning three major seasons of immigration. Now, the massive one is in the 1840s, 50s to Louisville, and that is a season in which it is estimated that at least a third of Louisvillians would have been foreign-born, at least a third, if not more. Then there is a season of continuing European immigration. By the way, the first phase of that massive immigration is substantially Germans in a 2-to-1 ratio with Irish. Many of the Germans will be, many of the Germans will be Roman Catholic. A decent piece will be German Protestants, and a much smaller but interesting piece will be German-speaking Jews. And there is no nation called Germany, and so when I speak of Germans, I'm speaking of German-speaking people from the various principalities as well as other areas where German is spoken, including German-speaking Switzerland. And so as a result, that is that first phase is massive immigration, and then from the period of about the Civil War, basically, to on through the end of the 19th century, into the 20th century, to maybe World War I, is a second phase of immigration from Europe, smaller in number, but significant and more diverse in its constituency, in the sense that you get toward the end of that phase, from 1860 to 1910 or 15, you get people who are more southern European as well as the Levant, the eastern Mediterranean with the Syrians and Lebanese. And so that's the second phase. And then the third phase will be that period after World War II with an entirely different complexion of immigration beginning in the 1990s and continuing to the present. So those are basically the three periods of what I would say big bumps or smaller significant bumps in immigration to Louisville over time. And so by 1860, by the way, after two decades of that massive immigration, the River City, pumped up by newcomers, had become one of the top dozen largest cities in the United States. Now, during the decades after the Civil War, Louisville continued to attract German and Irish newcomers in a steady but smaller stream. And as the turn of the century approached, as I indicated, by relatively small numbers of Greeks, Italians, Lebanese Syrians, as well as Eastern European Jews. These are some of the patterns of immigration in that first phase. The city experienced declining numbers of immigrants in the decades on either side of World War I, seeing a small bounce in the 1930s and early 40s, and this is despite U.S. restrictions on immigration, and that smaller bounce was from Jews fleeing Nazi oppression in German-speaking regions of Europe. Those refugees, by the way, and the documents are fascinating to look at. Those refugees from the late 1930s and early 1940s who were Jewish primarily were aided by local and national organizations as well as the University of Louisville seeking displaced academics. And several members of the University of Louisville faculty came to Louisville as part of those programs. Now, after World War II, the city attracted a small number of newcomers from India and Pakistan, attracted by local educational opportunities and aided by their command of English learned under colonial rule. At about the same time, immigrants from Korea arrived, fanned by U.S. involvement in a war there, and that nation's long-standing association with the Christian tradition through missionaries primarily from the U.S. The 1970s were marked by the arrival of refugees from Vietnam after the U.S. withdrawal there, as well as Iranians, some of whom had been studying here in the U.S. under the Shah, and then under the radical Islamic movement in Iran, sought refuge in the West, as well as Soviet Jews who were allowed to immigrate to the U.S. under an organizational sponsor. Now, in about the same era, and continuing over several decades, a significant enclave of refugees from Castro's Cuba formed in our community. Other refugees, as you'll recall, aided by local folks who were citizens of conscience and without government authorization, aided the fleeing to Louisville from violence and oppression in Central American countries during revolutions as well as dictatorships in that country. And just a little later, significant numbers of both documented and undocumented immigrants from Mexico came to the city for work. Interestingly, though, and this is what makes Louisville somewhat unique, our total number of Spanish-speaking newcomers in the 70s, 80s, and the 90s fell substantially short of the numbers arriving in other comparable cities of the U.S. Relatively speaking, in the 90s and into this decade and beyond, we will have more refugees from other countries than will we have Hispanics, and that is exactly the reverse in many cities of the United States. Now, Louisville's present-day immigration profile, and now we're talking about that third phase of the latter part of the third phase, has been massively influenced by the aggressive work of local resettlement organizations like the Kentucky Refugee Ministries and Catholic Charities, as well as the Jewish Family and Career Services. Since the 1990s, those groups have worked tirelessly with federal agencies to bring to our city thousands of new residents from far-flung regions of the world. Virtually all of those refugees, all of them, notice I'm using at this point refugees vis-a-vis immigrants, virtually all of those refugees were fleeing either civil war or ethnic or religious cleansing in their countries. They include, early on, significant numbers of Bosnians, and later on, Europeans, and later on, the Lost Boys of the Sudanese Dinka tribe, the Karen and Karini people of Myanmar, the Congolese Tutsis of the Somali Bantus, and victims of genocide in Rwanda. And as Peggy Clements just reminded me, the Ahuska from Turkey who had been displaced by the Soviets from Crimea. And a goodly number, 800 or so, live now in this community. And I did mention the victims of genocide in Rwanda. While many of the Bosnians came work-ready with manual and academic skills, the latter groups that I mentioned earlier from Africa and Southeast Asia, the latter groups generally had many more language, cultural, and educational challenges before they could perform anything but the most menial work. From the work of those resettlement agencies over the past 20 years, Louisville has become a big refugee resettlement city, while continuing, however, to have a very small percentage of our people who live here as foreign-born, considerably less than 5%. Now, since the 1840s, and now I'm shifting, talking now about some of the reasons that over this long span of time, people have both chosen and been directed to come to our city. Newcomers have immigrated to our city for a wide variety of reasons, ranging, and this is an interesting notion, and I would not begin to want to put my finger on it any further. I wonder sometime if some of the early immigrants who came to our city were just fidgety adventurers. They're that member of your family who had attention deficit disorder or whatever. I mean, obviously they were not comfortably niched, in some cases at least, where they were. And they just, by gosh, wanted to get out of Dodge and go somewhere. That was certainly, I think, true in some aspects of the 19th century. So I wonder if they were sort of misfits back home. And also, people came in the 19th century and later in pursuit of personal or political freedom, the desire to improve their lot economically and to escape from debilitating societal upheaval. 1870s, 1880s, there were people uncomfortable with the rise of the German nation, for instance. Or, in our more recent times and back in the 1840s, flight from famine or persecution. For the most part, however, all of our immigrants and refugees over these many years have been joined by the fundamental and, for me, the traumatic reality that except for the rarest exception, oh, I'll admit, air travel in modern times helps a little bit, and so does cell phone worldwide communication. But I promise you, most of the people who came and who are coming will never go home again, will never go home again. And that just seems to me to be fundamental, whether by considered choice or personal and family desperation. A human being who comes to our city from across the great waters has been ripped from the possibility of nurturing soil of family and community. And that just seems to me to be a fundamental uniting aspect of all the people who came. Now, the story of Louisville's immigrants through history is much more than a series of individual biographies. And here's the key. When there are sufficient numbers, the newcomers united themselves through language or country of origin, and they quickly coalesced with their kinspeople from afar to create a substantial subculture that softened the shock of arriving here. And frequently, those who came, I think of the Gustave Wolfing letters back to Germany from the late 1830s, where it was a family living close to the river in downtown Louisville, and they are frightened here, seized by possibility and opportunity, but this is a violent and strange world for them. And they are, as a family unit, somewhat hunkered down. So in that time of large-scale 19th century German and Irish arrivals, talking about how there were immediate efforts to try to make being here feel more like being back at home. Does it make any sense to you? That's an interesting dynamic. The German-speaking population, for instance, tended to ultimately gather together in patterns of neighborhood residency. For instance, they tended to live along the Shelby Street corridor, beginning in 1840 at, say, Shelby and Market, and then proceeding southbound along the Shelby Street corridor all the way out to Germantown, Schnitzelburg, with another enclave headed up the river toward Butchertown. That's where the Germans generally... And then they also had a smaller enclave in the emerging, in a portion of the emerging California neighborhood south of Broadway and east of what's Dixie Highway in today's world, around Brown Foreman's headquarters. And so that's where the German, so they felt more comfortable staying together, right, when they could. And so it was true also, and then there were the rural German settlements along Dixie Highway, Cane Run Road, as well as modern-day suburban Jeffersontown. There would have been smaller enclaves of German rural folks out in that area as well. Now, the early Jewish newcomers tended to locate, and they're coming in two pieces, one very early in the 1840s, and they're going to be German-speaking easily, and therefore tending to be somewhat more liberal and urbane, and then a much, much more ghettoized German would be coming in the 1890s and into the 20th century, and they're going to be religiously and ideologically much, much more conservative in their worldview. But both groups, over time, settled in that area between Preston and, say, Floyd, beginning along, say, Market Street and headed south across Broadway and headed into... there were five, six synagogues in that corridor alone, in the area on either side of the Wave Garden at Floyd and Broadway. And so that's where the Jewish population tended to feel more comfortable among themselves. As far as the Irish are concerned, they're going to tend to be Broadbrush, tend to be west of downtown. They're going to be starting at, say, Main Street and heading along the 6th Street corridor with a branch headed toward the Portland neighborhood, and they will be moving southbound, tending toward the west of downtown. Now, as far as that later 19th century and early 20th century immigration pattern from Europe, the Greeks and the Italians and even the Lebanese will be closer to the city center, and the Lebanese Syrians as well as the Italians will be gathered more or less around the Haymarket. And when opportunity provides, of course, they will be moving away from that area. Now, this tendency of many immigrants to stick together, you know what's going to happen. It's going to magnify the criticism of suspicious and unwelcoming nativists, claiming that the newcomers are cliquish and potentially un-American because they are continue trying to preserve some of their old ways. Cliquish and potentially un-American. Now, this search for comfort of numbers was further enhanced by early formation of religious congregations that appealed to Louisville's ethnic populations. And among that, I mentioned the synagogues along the corridor, the Floyd Street corridor, and there will be even a differentiation, as I indicated, between that first wave of Jewish immigration, which will tend to be liberal progressive, and then that later wave, which will tend to be much more orthodox, much more fundamental in their religious beliefs, much more conservative and traditional in their religious beliefs. Among the Roman Catholics, very early on, congregations like St. Louis Bertrand in the Limerick neighborhood, is that a clue, was clearly Irish, while St. Martin's and St. Boniface toward the east, where the Germans were more concentrated, were clearly early German congregations. There is, in fact, some indications, and this is an interesting footnote. I saw this played out in the Butchertown neighborhood, where Bishop McCloskey was actually trying to make sure that the Irish Catholics with a small congregation in the Butchertown neighborhood were not allowed to join the German Catholic Church in the Butchertown neighborhood, St. Joseph's, which is a very, very interesting dynamic that they, strikingly, among the Protestants, and this is amazing, among the German-speaking Protestants, there were German Methodists, there were German Baptists, and of course there were the more popular German Lutherans as well as the evangelicals, which Evangelikisch Kirkus, we think of them more recently in Louisville history as the ENR. That was a result of a merger of those German-speaking congregations. Similarly, in the 19th century, the newcomers from around the Mediterranean formed an Orthodox congregation and sometimes were able to join Roman Catholic, two Orthodox congregations ultimately, and were also moved freely into Roman Catholic congregations where they found solace with immigrants from their country of origins. There are two interesting talking about carrying those traditions from the old country, those ways, those building coalescence, trying to replicate some of the feelings of back home, even in the new home. There are two stories that come from the Irish church in the Limerick neighborhood, and they indicate the extent in which they were replicating home for those Irish immigrants. One priest, interestingly enough, encouraged his congregation there at St. Louis Bertrand to wake up and to get strong and to get tough and to volunteer by calling out to them, remember the anti-immigrant riots of 1855. Which is, I think, an interesting call to volunteerism within a congregation. While the congregational picnics in that same congregation held at Floral Park in the old Louisville neighborhood had picnic tables with a sign attached to each table with the name of the county in Ireland from which you came, and you were to sit with your old county folks from the old sod there in the picnic. A review in talking about this further identity maintaining of these newcomers, especially these massive numbers of Irish and Germans. A review of Louisville's annual city directories in the late 19th century reveals there were 5 German language newspapers or literary magazines in Louisville, and among them, notably, the Louisville Anzeiger, which began daily publication in Louisville in 1849 and continued in some form in Louisville until 1938. But there were literary magazines, daily newspapers, all, can you imagine seeing that delivered on somebody's front porch and say, come on, get with it. Get American, for God's sake. You know? Get American. And so as a result, in addition to that, there were innumerable German-speaking singing, gymnastic, and above all, numerous benevolent societies. I mean, the list that in that front of that annual city directory is almost endless, both in the German-speaking community involving Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, as well as the Irish immigrant society as well. Those societies, especially the benevolent societies, provided a rudimentary safety net for immigrants who became disabled, fell on hard times, or lost a wage earner. Of course, the German-speaking groups included specific organizations from German-speaking Switzerland, as well as for German-speaking Jews. There's one old Benevolent Society booklet that is written in German for the first 10 years in the 1860s and the 1870s in the Jewish community. In the same fashion, the Catholic Irish, in addition to their parish churches, formed benevolence and charitable organizations, as well as quasi-religious social groups like the Hibernians and the Knights of Columbus. And they also had strong weekly newspapers in the 1840s out of the diocesan headquarters, originally in Bardstown and then later Louisville, was called The Advocate. It went under, but then it was reborn again in the 1860s. It was a strident, assertive newspaper on Irishness and on Roman Catholicism, as well as what we now know as The Record, dating from the 19th century. And then by the end of the century, the colorful weekly, the Kentucky Irish American, helped shape public opinion and informed that immigrant community of the developments in the old country, which was fundamental, especially until 1920. Now, those two large 19th century immigrant groups also established, and this again is almost endless, religiously and ethnically based orphanages and retirement homes. I think, for instance, quickly off the top of my head, where was the German Baptist orphanage? Just off of Cherokee Road, still stands there in the Cherokee Triangle neighborhood. And where was the German Protestant orphanage? Mid-City Mall. Sure, Mid-City Mall. Right. And so those are just minor examples of what I am describing here. Now, the sheer numbers of Roman Catholic newcomers in the decades on either side of the Civil War emboldened their leaders to engage the majority society stridently. Don't you take no off of them, was the attitude. Do you understand what I'm saying? And so in The Advocate, you're talking about engagement of the majority community. In the rhetorical fisticuffs with nativist critics before the Bloody Monday riots of 1855, Catholic Bishop Martin J. Spaulding assertively called for public funds to support parochial education, as well as requiring the use of the douay, the Catholic version of the scriptures, as part of morning opening exercises in the public schools. Increasingly, armed with the vote, and this is fundamental, I think, to both past, present, and future immigration to our society. Thank God for the vote and the ability to elect their own in ward-based elections. If you're huddling together in a ward-based election, you may have a chance to turn an election, to get one of your own elected who would represent your ethnic or religious interest. And so as a result, the latter demand, that is the demand for what kind of Bible are you going to read in the public schools and morning exercises? Is it going to be the hated King James? Or is it going to be the Catholic scriptures? That was taken on in a plan in the early 1870s before the Louisville Board of Education, and it was a strange plan that was hatched, and it allowed Catholic public school parents to withdraw their children from morning exercises rather than to hear the hated King James Version of the Bible read. That same growing political clout, once these immigrants got the vote, can be seen in several City of Louisville Council votes, like one, and there were numerous examples of this, condemning English mistreatment of their Irish subjects, and even in a failed resolution 15 years after Bloody Monday riots, seeking indemnification for property loss during that rioting. Or to say it another way, you would have never brought it to the City Council if you didn't think you had a little bit of a chance getting it passed by the early 1870s, 15 years after the event occurred. Over time, immigrant families from that second smaller wave of immigration in the late 19th century and the early 20th century became recognizable on ballots as well for public office. Now, currently, local churches and Islamic, Hindu, and Buddhist worship centers serve, even in our own time, as rallying centers for our immigrants who have arrived since World War II. I give you a classic example. Was it last year or the year before that the Roman Catholic bishop designated St. John Vianney Church on Southside Drive as a congregation that was going to be led against the objections of a remaining Anglo few in that congregation? It was going to be run, determined by the will of the Vietnamese congregation majority that was in that church. And in front of that church on Southside Drive, there is Our Lady and the Dragon statue straight out of Vietnam, right? And so that is an example of our own time as to how a Roman Catholic congregation are in terms of social service kinds of activities. The Somalis, after one of their own murdered his family, they formed a social service center and a rallying point for the Somali congregation on Southern Parkway by renting an Episcopal church-owned space there. And so as a result, you still see these kinds of coalescing, though in modern times, one of the greatest challenges to the immigrant community is that they are splintered under so many different language groups, so many different religious groups, so many different customs, and so you have nothing like that kind of coalescing on a massive scale that we saw in the 19th century. Furthermore, there is no immigrant group that can coalesce in one location strong enough, not even in the South End, this side of Iroquois Park, that can coalesce in a strong enough number to actually get one of their own elected. And interestingly enough, in the 19th century, one of the things that tended to bridge the relative diverse German population, all of it a majority Roman Catholic, was the unifying element of the Roman Catholic Church. Because you had both very distinct groups, Irish and Germans, language group broke. And you had two very, very distinguished groups, but in a sense, both politically and culturally, the Roman Catholic Church provided some unifying factor there. Now, over the decades, our city, and I suspect we're not too unusual in this regard, has had an ambiguous attitude toward the newcomers who have come to town. The Bloody Monday riots that I've already alluded to was the only time that the negative reaction to immigrants flamed up and actually caused up to at least 22 deaths in the community with a 24-hour season of burning, pillaging, and killing. And that occurred, or associated with the August 1855 elections. The riots occurred, of course, during that massive influx of mostly Roman Catholic Germans and Irish, as well as a time of significant political convulsion. The venerable National Whig Party was splintering apart over slavery, and on its ruin, a short-lived anti-immigrant American Party had found both local and regional favor. American Party, they're the know-nothings, same bunch. Historians continue today to compile a growing list. You look back and you tell me what caused the Bloody Monday riots of 1855. That list grows every year, a growing list of the causes. But suffice it to say, nativist public record exuded vitriol and suspicion toward Catholic newcomers for years. And in addition, the defenders of the church, including Bishop Spalding, even found fleeting security in their growing numbers and refused to take ridicule lying down. Now, the fear of the newcomers, not only was it Roman Catholic, the fear of the newcomers in the 1855 rioting was exacerbated by a dotted line group of German immigrants who had come fleeing the failed revolutions in Europe, the liberal revolutions in Europe in 1848. Those people came with such radical notions, they would have scared the pants off of you and me. They wanted women's rights, abolition of slavery, direct election of U.S. senators, and the elimination of the death penalty. And this was the national headquarters of those group of German immigrants who were advocating those extreme positions. Now, the spark for the riot, however, was the heavy-handed control by the majority know-nothing party of the polling places that election day that made it harder for the newly minted citizens to cast their votes. Now, throughout the 19th century, local groups that resisted immigration pushed to stretch out the number. Oh, what are you going to do to stop them? Number one, you're going to try to, this was debated in the 1849, failed happily, the 1849 Constitutional Convention for the new Constitution in Kentucky. Here's an idea to stop immigrant political power. How about requiring, and the states controlled this until the early 20th century, that is, how you became a citizen. How about making it 21 years rather than the 5 years normally? So you come as an immigrant, wait 21 years until you, because the nativists argued, as you might well imagine, with a little whiskey and the influence of the cleric, then they got your vote in the pocket, and they're not really thoughtful citizens exercising the privilege of voting, as you can imagine. And so as a result, that was one of the arguments that was made. In that second wave, not as many, but in that second wave in the late 1880s, the 1890s, the Greeks more felt nationwide, but here in Kentucky and here locally, there was a subset wing of the Republican Party, since most of the immigrants voted Democratic from day one. And so as a result, that subset of the Republican Party was called the American Protective Association. You know what they did? They stood at the polls with a sample ballot. May I offer you a second sample ballot? There would be a list of the candidates above the names of the Roman Catholics or the Roman Catholic sympathizers would be the name Romanist or Papist. And beside the name of the more favorable Republican candidate, who likely was Protestant, would be the title American. And this is in the late 1880s and the 1890s. And so there you're going to get to the one of the major ways of showing irritation with immigration. And I think this even continues in our own time, but it certainly was true in the 19th and early 20th century, is that you challenged expressed your frustration as a nativist with the continual use of the foreign language. I give you an example. Just on either side, and I'm not sure of the date, but I have the slides. These are glass slides used by the Louisville Women's Club during American Speech Week. And one of those slides says during Better Speech Week, foreign languages in America keep us apart. And so you think they would be offended by the Daily Louisville Anzeiger, for instance? I suspect so. Would they be? So they were wanting Americans who had immigrated to this country to get with it. Or Henry Watterson hated the thought of hyphenated Americans, he called, that divided the American public. Irish-American, Italian-American. He hated and railed against the use of the term hyphenated Americans. There was even a movement in the city council during that 1890s season of anti-immigrant fervor to remove the names of all streets in Louisville that were named for saints. Come up with a name for St. Catherine Street, if you will, or St. Louis Street, if you will. Ultimately, of course, that occurred to a certain extent in the anti-German hysteria of World War I. As you know, Bismarck Street in West Louisville was renamed in World War I for the commandant of the U.S. Military Training Center here in Louisville. His name was Hale, and so it was renamed Hale Avenue for General Hale. Now, much more recently in our time, the argument against continuing immigration. Now, there are those, and this is what I'll conclude, throughout this whole season of massive immigration, relatively smaller, and then since World War II, not massive immigration by any stretch of the imagination, but continuing patterns of immigration, especially in the late 90s and the 21st century, those refugees from many, many foreign places in the world. Throughout that whole time, there have been voices in Louisville that said, lay out the welcome mat. I give you an example. The very, very classic example of that was a few years before Bloody Monday, a local historian in his published work lamented that Louisville was so far behind our rival cities in promoting German immigration to our city. And just 12 months before that major riot, a local business promotion organization petitioned the city council to promote our city as a welcoming destination for foreign immigrants. Now, frankly, I think you can translate that in the 19th century as meaning European immigrants. But nevertheless, there was, even a year before Bloody Monday, voices being heard in the community saying, roll out the welcome mat. Indeed, there was massive growth of our community after the Civil War and the creation of jobs, and I think in large part due to the significant immigration of that late 19th century. Now, much more recently, each mayor or administration has argued that those urban areas that fail to attract newcomers, both from within our community, within our nation, and outside our country, will inevitably decline. They argue that our workforce is aging. I can testify to that. Without opportunity-seeking younger people, the community will not be able to sustain its older population as they continue to live longer. In addition, many local leaders argue, and now this is the current argument for continued immigration, that our city's cultural fabric is actually enriched by newcomers from afar, while other advocates want our community to be a beacon of opportunity for the oppressed from around the world. Think Statue of Liberty. Currently, through the Office of Globalization, Mayor Greg Fisher seeks, among other things, to assist refugees and immigrants to our community to consider and to assist them in going into private enterprises. So then, over those many decades since 1840s, Louisvillians have generally been of two minds, and you have heard them, either resistance and irritation and frustration and somewhat being put off by the continued use of foreign customs, foreign languages, foreign ways, and then the other perspective, which has continued throughout that whole period, which is one understanding the economics and the cultural advantages of welcoming new people to our community. Thank you very, very much. Judy, we have time for a few minutes?
Yeah.
Well, you tap the top of your head when you want me to close her down. Okay. Yes, sir. Back on the... I see you with your hand up. You have glasses. You have my color hair. About this much.
The South, generally speaking, hasn't it been the least welcoming area of the United States of America? That was, slavery, and then after that, segregation. That took a lot of jobs out of the marketplace. And we have suffered because of that, because the South is solid again only as Republican. It hasn't changed a damn bit.
Yeah.
So I welcome the South back into the Union.
All I can say is that I do clearly, I did not find that citation, but I do clearly remember in the historical records of the L&N Railroad, as well as I know from other reading, other American railroads, they actively promoted European immigration because the more stops you can have on a new railroad line with resettled immigrant communities, the better your business is going to be. It's just that simple. And I'm almost positive, now I can't swear by that, but I'm also sure, I'm almost positive that the L&N was involved in the same kind of promotion, at least to some extent, in the 1870s. Yes, sir, over on the far right. Well, all I can say, Mr. Prentice was editor of the Louisville Journal, and he was a recent convert to the more virulent form of anti-immigrant rhetoric and vitriol. It is clearly there. I didn't mention, well, let me just as an aside say that I'm not much for toppling statues, either as a child of both Yankees and Confederates, but I'm just not much on toppling statues, as was certainly the case in Louisville in 1955, 100 years later after Bloody Monday. There were real genuine demands for bringing down the statue of George Prentice. All I can say is the more I read of newspapers, and 19th century newspapers only existed to elect the people in your party. Please understand that. Nothing but the news, you can forget that. I mean, there can be some news in the newspaper, yes, but more than anything else, you're there to promote your candidate and to attack your opponent. So all kinds of pre-Civil War and post-Civil War presses, be they Prentice or be they the Catholic Advocate, are going to be strident in their rhetoric. Strident in their rhetoric. And so I have just never... By the way, the word I learned in graduate school that I devoutly appreciated, it fundamentally altered my whole notion of being a historian, and that's the word historiography, which is the ongoing debate about why and its result, what happened and what its result, and causation. There is the only piece of Louisville history for which there is a significant and ongoing historiography is the causation of the Bloody Monday riots of 1855. There are literally articles on the role of George Prentice in causing that riot, and then the next article, either in the Filson Historical Quarterly or in the Kentucky Register, will be the reinterpretation of the role of George Prentice in causing that riot. So, and that's frankly the juice that keeps me going in American history, is that the fact that every generation reviews the causation and story. I see one here, and then I'll come to there, and then back there. Yes, ma'am, right here. Small, early, and small, but enduring. Yeah. Not many in the French early on were deeply ensconced in the shipping port in Portland area. And they continued there. I can take you to the Portland Cemetery and show you bilingual gravestones, which is wonderful. So the Portland neighborhood, now, of course, with prosperity, they lived in the better part of Portland, and then they were able ultimately to move further out into other neighborhoods. But early, relatively small, but enduring, it would be my words. Yes. Yeah. Yes, yes, yeah. There was always, and that would be always an argument, and I didn't even mention an argument against immigration, is that it's going to lower the minimum wage. And I don't mean a government-determined minimum wage. It's going to depress the wage market with immigrants willing to work for less and less because they were so desperate. And so organized labor, for instance, will frequently be caught in a bind on that very issue. And I think to some extent still caught in a little bind on that very issue. But yes, immigrant, and the whole problem of slavery, as indicated, is also part of that same mix. But yes, immigrant labor is, so why would the poorest of the Limerick neighborhood be adjacent to the L&N car shops in the Limerick neighborhood before 1906 when they moved to South Louisville? That's because they walked across the street to work in the L&N car shops, the poorest of the Irish labor. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I'm looking at you. It's just that I got a cocked eye, I believe. Well, I think that early, that first massive wave, I think no doubt there was suspicion between the German Catholics even, but the German Catholics and the German and the Irish Catholics made up a massive portion of that 1840s and 1850s, and frankly on in smaller numbers, but significant numbers on into the 1870s, 1880s. Their animosity would have been somewhat modulated. Now, I'm speculating here. I don't have documents. I don't have a footnote for this. I'm speculating. Would have been somewhat modulated by the unifying element of the Mass and the Roman Catholic Church. So there could have been perfect reason. But remember, the beautiful thing of being German for an Irishman is that he's not English. Right? And, oh, I'll give you an example. I mean, you're talking about askance. The Kentucky Irish American in 1914. By 1915, the head of the National Hibernians is coming to 1915. Now, your boys are going to go off to Europe very soon thereafter. What's the Kentucky Irish American talking about? This is an Englishman's war in Europe. You can forget it, Jack. You can forget it. Now, somehow, those Irish sons of Irish immigrants picked up the beat by 1917. But I'm telling you, the articulate, more educated Irish leadership press in the Kentucky Irish American in 14 and 15 are saying, this ain't our war. Let the hated English fight it out with them. And what would be so bad I remember reading this article in the Kentucky Irish American the last 2 weeks. What would be so different than the Kaiser's boot versus the English boot on our throats? Come say, come sa. So that's a very, very interesting dynamic. Same problem. It's interesting, by the third generation, second and third generation of Germans, Anzeiger is slow to pick up the beat, is required by the federal government on its masthead, and I have it in my notes, I just didn't read it to you, on its masthead, we are Americans and love with you the same flag. But they also had to include in its masthead basically a pledge of allegiance to the United States. The Daily Louisville Anzeiger during World War I. Very interesting. Maybe one more? Yes, sir.
Would you characterize the Flood of 37 as a movement towards more ethnic movement?
The Flood of 1937 scared people in the floodplain. It was before a wall. We now live behind a 29-mile-long wall, which, if it doesn't rain too hard, won't be breached. You heard what I just said. Won't be breached. But the 29. But before, there was no wall in 37. And so when people who could afford it looked up in January and February of 1937 and saw the living room with mud, with muddy water and a mud mark once you got back in the house, up above, right at the base of the picture frame, they sought and I think dreamed of opportunities to move elsewhere. I don't think there's any question about it. The flood was a dynamic that would move people out of the floodplain, be it east downtown or west and southwest of downtown. No question. No question. Yes. Yes. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for joining us tonight. We will start anew tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. I hope to see you all here, and I appreciate you being here, and have a very good evening.